Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, earned an AB in Economics and American Studies from Princeton, and an MBA in Finance and Corporate Strategy from the University of Michigan. Since 2005, he's been the president and CEO of Residential Home Health, a subsidiary of Graham Holdings Company, and specializes in partnering with health systems, hospitals, nursing facilities, and large physician practices in reducing post-acute risk. His name, David Curtis, a great friend. And I'm Jack Quisullo. And this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJI. I'm Jack Quisullo. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're David Curtis. Since 2005, he's been the president and CEO of Residential Home Health. David, welcome. An honor to have you.
Great to be here, Jack.
We had your better half here a few years ago, but finally we get you.
Yeah, hopefully the sequel will be at least as good.
Okay, tall cotton. All right, let's go back to high school. You've had a history of caring and making people, okay? So you played basketball for Country Day, and you had this nobody on the team that you made. His name was Chris Webber.
Yeah.
How good was he?
Unbelievable. I remember I played with him for 1 year. My senior year, his freshman year. It was the 1 year he didn't win a state championship was when I was his teammate. But I remember going to see Coach Keener and in his freshman year. He's like, I'm not sure he's going to start. We'll have to see. It's a big maybe with Chris. Anyhow, from the first jump, he was all that he became to be. And it was a fun year playing basketball. I had a front row seat to most of that action. Keeping the bench warm, but Country Day and playing with Chris and Coach Bartishup on the soccer team, it was a great experience.
All right. Then you go to Princeton. Yeah. Princeton is the fourth oldest institution of higher education in the United States. It was formed 277 years ago in 1746. That was before the American Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about Princeton.
My mother was from New Jersey. Her father had been accepted to Princeton, but wasn't able to go because of the Depression. And so I would say my mother sort of pointed me in that direction, and I applied and visited and got in early, and it was a great 4 years. I was on the crew team. I ran a business there. It was a great 4 years, and it was focused on undergraduate studies, which was what drew me to it, and I have great memories of my time there.
And you made another nobody. His name was Teddy Cruz.
Oh, yeah.
You guys were on the same yearbook page together.
Yep.
You know, Curtis and Cruz. Tell us about Senator Teddy Cruz.
I didn't know him that well. We were on the same page of the yearbook. He was a champion debater. Mm-hmm. I remember his father was, I believe, a Cuban refugee. We had a few interesting members of our class. The other was that one of the Menendez brothers was in my class, who were quite a story in their own. But Princeton was, I was just inspired by many of my classmates in terms of what they could accomplish and just the caliber. It like Country Day, Princeton sort of pushed me with just a great peer group.
All right, from 97. To 2005, you were in the consulting business,
mm-hmm.
9 years, first with Diamond Management and Technology Consultants, mm-hmm. and then the last 4 years, Leland Partners. Talk about that chapter in your life.
Well, I graduated from Michigan Business School, and consulting was a great job if you're really unsure what you wanted to do. And so you got exposure to lots of different companies, different industries, different business problems, working on unrealistic timelines. And so it was just a great business residency. I worked in the music business, the packaging business, the telecom business. I got a broad-based exposure to a variety of business problems and management teams in it. And it was just a great way to learn quickly. But I knew ultimately that's not, consulting isn't a way to build a family or to build a career. And so in 2001, I quit on the verge of being a partner at Diamond and came back to Michigan because I wanted to start a family, and this is where my roots were. And so I sort of did it on my own without a firm. And through some Country Day connections, got a job working at General Motors, thanks to our good friend Rick Wagner, and a job at Sintel, working with Bharat Desai. And, you know, one thing led to another. And ultimately, one of those clients was Mount Clemens General Hospital that had a home health business that was struggling. And I got into a turnaround opportunity there and got exposed to that business. And I said, hey, home health is an interesting business. This is 20 years ago.
Let's hold that off, though.
Yeah.
Okay, if you want to learn more, www.residentialhealthcaregroup.com. All right, we're talking to David Curtis, and he's led two lives, before Dana and after Dana. August 5th, 2005, you go on a blind date.
Yeah, my dad came home with three phone numbers on a sticky note. A patient of his said, hey, maybe Dana should call this girl Dana. And I had known about her because another friend at one point had tried to set me up with her, but for some reason it didn't work out. So I called Dana. We went to dinner, went to a Neil Diamond concert at the Palace. She had tickets from her job at Kelly Services. And I knew almost immediately that this, because I was 35, and at times I was like, Lord, am I going to get married? Am I going to find, you know, someone that I want to spend the rest of my life with? I had my doubts. And then all
the Lord said, be careful what you pray for.
Yeah. Okay. And then she just sort of showed up she just sort of showed up one day in my life. And it's been a great partnership.
We got to be careful what we talk about her because, you know, if she doesn't like what we say, she'll never show up again in your life. Okay. All right. You marry her. She gets pregnant on Labor Day 2008.
Mm-hmm.
February 13th, 2009,
mm-hmm.
a miracle happens. When we come back, we're going to find out what's that miracle mm-hmm. all about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula with David Curtis, who married Dana. And February 13th, 2009, a miracle is born. Christian, please.
It was perhaps one of the greatest blessings, and I would say the greatest challenge in my life. Christian was born 13 weeks early. He spent 277 days in two NICUs. He was on a ventilator and feeding tube for 2.5 years. We spent $3 million saving his life, you know, with nurses and the prayers of hundreds, Jack. And, you know, Christian is a walking miracle. Today he's 14 and a half, but Dan and I learned a lot about faith, about I didn't realize how little empathy I had until I had Christian, and I spent the better part of 2 years in NICUs and children's hospitals. And Christian is God is still writing his story. And we were told before we went to the delivery room that he had a 20% chance of living, and he's still at it. But Christian was not something that I had ever planned for, right? Everyone has a vision for, I'm going to have a child. I think many people wanted to be a son. He was our first son. But it wasn't as probably we would have written the story, but I have learned so much from Christian.
What's the biggest thing Christian has taught you, Dad?
This is going to sound cliche, and it's a combination of making sure we don't have misplaced expectations. You know, I had expectations of my first son that, you know, Christian, those aren't going to be. But it's also trusting the Lord that he will work it out, and he'll redeem it, and he'll work it out for good. And we're still on that journey 14 years later. There are things about Christian that we're still trying to sort out for him. But I just keep, Dan and I just keep plodding forward one day at a time, one step at a time, and doing our part as parents, but trusting that the Lord will redeem it all.
Later, Sterling, Isla Bliss.
Yep.
Truman.
Yeah.
What have your three other children learned from Christian?
How to be patient, how to be a sibling. We had Sterling with Christian on a ventilator. We had Truman when Dana was almost 49. Right? So I repeated first grade, and I joke I've been behind ever since. We had all our children when I was in my 40s. Dana into her late 40s. And so all four of them, it's been again, not how I would have written this story, but it's, and my life is full with four kids from 14 to 5.
If there's a mom or dad tonight listening that says, boy, I relate to this. We just had a special needs child. Mm-hmm. David, I don't know if I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to him or her?
Yes, you can. I don't think God would have put you in those circumstances if he also didn't feel like he could see you through it. Ask for help from friends, from family. Ask for prayers. That's very humbling, actually, to do that. And so, but we can do more than we think we can. I was just thankful too to have an amazing spouse and wife and partner who has just had a never quit mentality. And you need that, I think, in a life partner. We're not supposed to go it alone, I don't think.
What role did prayer play for you and Dana?
Well, the Christian put our faith to the test, right? It's one thing to go to church. It's another thing to have your child in a NICU for 9 months and have him die or almost die several times. And it's like, Lord, where are we going here? Like, what's the point of all this? And I remember one time Christian was in the NICU. I basically went home to shower and was at the NICU at 13 and Woodward for most of that time. And I remember going home one night when Christian had almost died because he had a trach plug and he was saved at 3 a.m. And I went into his nursery, which we had all perfectly decorated, and you could have sold tickets to this thing. And Christian, as it turned out, never spent a night in that nursery in our house because when he came home on a ventilator, he didn't go upstairs. But I went into that nursery and got on my knees, and I was like, Lord, where are we going here? Like, I didn't pray. I prayed the most authentic prayer I think I've ever prayed to say, Lord, I don't know what the plan is. I trust you for that, but the circumstances need to change. And I went back to that hospital. And we couldn't get Christian off he had a trach, but we couldn't get him off the ventilator. And it turns out, I mean, it was a miracle. It turns out this respiratory therapist greeted me as I came back from that shower. My hair's probably still wet. And he said, oh my gosh, there was a setting wrong on this ventilator. The humidity was down, which was causing all these trach plugs. I fixed it. And within 4 weeks, Christian was at home with me on my couch watching the Michigan-Ohio State football game with me. And so, I think these kinds of situations, your faith gets tested. And I was glad to have that test, although on the front end, I probably wouldn't have signed up for it.
We're talking to David Curtis. He met Dana in 2005, and also he bought a little company in 2005 with 20 employees. And wow. When we come back, we'll ask him what was wow. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, with David Curtis. He acquired Residential Home Health in May of 2005. You had about 80 patients and about 20 employees. What's happened?
fast forward nearly, I guess, 19 years later, and we have 14,000 patients on service today, all home-based, home health and hospice. My brother-in-law, who's married to my wife's identical twin sister, has been my business partner in that. There's an unbelievable team of people that across Michigan, Illinois, Pennsylvania mostly, but we're also in Florida and Ohio and Missouri. But home-based care 20 years ago was kind of in the shadows of healthcare, and today it's where everyone wants to be. It's where the payers want to be because it's cost-effective. It's where patients want to be because that's where they're most comfortable. And I even say it's where nurses and therapists want to be because they get autonomy, they get flexibility, and they get to make a real difference and build rapport with patients. You know, we're caring for patients for, on average, 90 days at a time. And you build real relationships coming into someone's home, working with them on, you know, very personal things to ultimately keep them at home and safe and independent. And it's a great mission that we have. It's a great business that we have. Hopefully it's going to improve the solvency of Medicare by getting more people cared for at home. But it's been a great journey. You know, I grew up at the kitchen table of two entrepreneurs. My dad was a solo practitioner physician. My mom was an entrepreneur with her own ad agency. And I always liked sort of entrepreneurship and building a business. I saw my parents do it, and it's been a real blessing.
If you want to learn more, www.residentialhealthcaregroup.com. All right, 2014. You're acquired by Graham Healthcare Capital.
Mm-hmm.
What is Graham Healthcare Capital?
So Graham and Graham Holdings is the Graham family. It used to be the Washington Post Company, right? Publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange, owned by the Graham family, Catherine Graham. Don Graham is the chairman today, Catherine's son. My partners and I at the time felt like this is a business we wanted to keep running, but we didn't want to necessarily own it all ourselves. And so we went and ran a process to find a partner. And it turns out it was Graham. Warren Buffett has been on the board, was on the board of the Washington Post Company for 40 years. And they're very much sort of the Berkshire mentality of buy and hold, and all businesses are local. They own WDIV here in Detroit, Channel 4, and have for many years. And it's been a great partnership because they're supportive, but they don't mess with the culture, and they let the team run the business, I would say, pretty autonomously. And it's allowed us to flourish, and I think it's been stable. And in healthcare these days, everyone's combining, everyone's merging. All this consolidation creates all this disruption, and we're insulated from that because the Graham family and Graham Holdings, they just want to hold businesses for decades, and not having to deal with all that disruption, it allows you to focus on the business and the patients and the mission.
All right. Speaking of the culture, what's your culture?
So it's funny, we were just talking about this yesterday. I think our culture is, my consulting background taught me a lot about professional services. And I see our group very much like a professional service firm, where we have talented clinicians and professionals, and I want to give them the best resources to do the job. I would say we're a culture of growth. And I think growth is important so that individuals can advance, so that more opportunities come our way. It's hard to have an exciting business if you're not growing, that people want to come to and stick around. And so I think growth is a big part of it. And I just love when, if you look across our team, most of our team's been with us for 10 plus years. And so that continuity, I think, is important in making sure that culture stays in place. But I would say it's a supportive culture. It's an empathetic culture. And because of Graham, we're able to focus on the longer term than others and not having to worry about, you know, sort of quarterly short-term results, which makes it less stressful.
3,000 teammates. How does one propagate the culture throughout the entire organization, multiple states, et cetera?
Yeah. So I think ownership stability is a probably less than obvious element of that. I think leadership continuity, the tenure of our leadership team, we've been through it together. and I would say those are probably the two of the more interesting elements of our culture. And then, you know, our team, we have fun together, right? We enjoy being with each other. And I think we're all, you know, somebody becomes a nurse not because they want to become a millionaire. They become a nurse because they have a calling to help people. And I think that's another important part of our culture is we want professionals and clinicians, because we employ 1,000 nurses and several hundreds of therapists. I want them to feel like this is a place they can live out their mission while providing for their family and having a career. And so we're mission minded, right? And, you know, every patient that gets admitted to our service, we'll admit probably 50,000 home health patients this year. They all got my cell phone number. So if they're not happy, they can call me. And I think that there's also a culture, I would say, of service accountability. It's easy in healthcare to feel like you're lost in the system and who do I go to and how do I get out of this hospital, right? And in our world and with our company, we don't want you to feel like you're stuck. And if you've got a problem, you can talk to hopefully the problem solvers.
All right, you've got three basic offerings. Let's go through. First one, home health.
Yep. So generally paid for by Medicare, overseen by a physician. It's nursing, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, either for someone who's come out of a hospital, had a knee or hip replacement, somebody who's dealing with congestive heart failure. So it's chronic conditions, it's rehab situations, somebody had a stroke, we'll help you rehab at home. And it's very cost effective compared to nursing homes, hospitals, etc.
Second one, palliative care.
Yeah, so palliative care is nurse practitioners. Again, this is all in the home, Jack, or where patients live. Sometimes it's in a nursing home. But it's pain and symptom management, often for patients who are in transition, I would say ultimately to hospice, but they still want to pursue treatment. And it's just a great, I would say, bridge service to from home health to hospice.
All right, the last one being hospice care, please.
Yeah, hospice is an amazing benefit that's largely paid for through Medicare. It's an amazing benefit provided by our government, and allows people to spend the last days of their life at home comfortably, with dignity, right, as opposed to in an ICU perhaps. And it's very compassionate. And there's a full suite of services. It's nursing, it's chaplaincy, it's social work, it's a home health aide to help you with bathing and, you know, sort of the activities of daily living at end of life. It's a rich service that actually more people need to know about. And I think that's a big part of our mission, is making sure people know all the care that they can get at home through the benefits like Medicare.
If you want to learn more, www.residentialhealthcaregroup.com. When we come back, we're going to go back 3.5 years. Don't go away. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
Jack Crisula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.
Anything is possible.
I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to David Curtis. Since 2005, he's been the president and CEO of Residential Home Health. David, let's go back 3.5 years. March 2020. What do you remember?
COVID brought our business to a, I would say in some ways, a screeching halt. In other ways, we took off. We had everyone coming into the office, like a lot of businesses. All of a sudden, everyone, we got to figure out how to work from home. And thankfully, we're able to do that and pivot there nicely. The other thing that happened is all of our hospital partners and all of our hospital referral sources and nursing homes that send us patients to care for at home, they were looking to us for help because they wanted to get patients out of these congregate settings like a nursing home or a hospital and at home in isolation. But we weren't really sure what we were dealing with. We certainly took measures to manage infections, prevent the spread of infection, but COVID was a whole different animal. And so, we had to track down PPE from sources, the amount of gloves that we needed, the masks that we needed. It was all the rules changed, and we were having to figure out the rules somewhat on the fly. Even Medicare changed a lot of the regulations. One day, you couldn't care for patients unless they met a certain criteria. Now they're basically like, you can take care of any patient at home as long as you can sort of get them home. And I would say our federal government and HHS, Department of Health and Human Services and Medicare were very responsive, right? They gave us additional funds. I remember one Saturday I was on the phone with Seema Verma and about 100 others where she was asking leaders in our home health and hospice industry, what do you guys need? Like that was a 180.
And she was?
Head of Medicare. Prior to COVID, they wouldn't have taken our call. Now she was leading a conference call to help us on the weekend. So, I give credit in many respects to how the federal government really tried to support the U.S. health system through this sort of unprecedented time.
Your nurses, therapists never stopped going to the clients' homes for one day.
No.
You gave them masks, ventilators, all of them had it in the first day.
Yeah. And Detroit was hit harder than other places with COVID. And our nurses, our therapists, they didn't bat an eye. It's kind of like first responders, right? Everyone's coming out of the building, they're going in. That's the image here. And I probably haven't thanked them enough for all that they did to care for patients at a time when no one really knew what COVID was or what it meant for their own health and safety. But that's what is, I think, exciting to me about being part of this team is it's a team that's on a mission to serve and to care, even at their own expense.
How did you come up with masks, gloves, et cetera?
Got on the phone, met some new friends. And we were able to secure, ironically, we were able to secure lots of our PPE, personal protective equipment, gloves, masks from China. But it was we were buying three times the protective equipment in a month that we would spend in a year, because we didn't want our team to not have what they needed. Back to this professional service, sort of want to give everyone the resources, culture. We worked really hard and we were able to secure it. Thankfully, we're a larger provider, not as big as a health system, and some of our health system partners were able to help us with the equipment and the masks. But it was a bit of a, we got to figure this out quick and get on the phone and improvise. And we did.
All right, continuing on the same thing. I believe that modern day angels are amongst us.
Mm-hmm.
And we call them nurses.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about being a nurse today.
Well, nurses have to be clinical. I mean, they have to know how to treat patients. They have to have a certain amount of grit to go into. And our nurses don't go into these sort of sanitary hospital settings. They go into patients' homes, right, where there's a gun on the table, where there's a dog that won't stop barking, where there's another adult spouse who probably should be on our service too, right? These are not pristine environments. And here we are trying to support these 85-year-olds who have 3-5 chronic conditions or on 10 prescription drugs who are weak and sick. And our nurses have to go in there and lift them up and encourage them And it's a balance of clinical know-how, interpersonal savvy, grit, and compassion. And they do it with a smile. And it's just, these are, nurses are wired to be nurses. It's a calling, and it's a blessing to work alongside people like that, who are focused on helping others.
It's a calling. It's a ministry.
It is.
It's a vocation.
It is.
All right. What's the biggest few things these 1,000-plus nurses and clinicians have taught you, David Curtis?
Well, I go back to my story with Christian. I had never really been a beneficiary of Home Health Services till we bought Christian home, and he's on a ventilator. And a nurse would come to our house every night for 12 hours to watch Christian, because if he had an issue with his ventilator, they had to intervene. And, I sort of slept around the corner with one eye open as well. But I would say nurses, they're sort of never off the job, right? Because they've got these patients they're caring for. They've just taught me a lot, I think, Jack, about being tough and empathetic and helpful and encouraging, and also telling people what they need to hear, right? I would say I love physicians. My dad was a physician. But I think nurses are perhaps on average a bit better at telling patients what they need to hear so they can deal with the reality of their situation. And nurses, our therapists, our social workers, our chaplains, they're all in many ways cut from the same cloth. It's what makes patients love our service. It's why 40% of our patients we've had before and they come back to us.
www.residentialhealthcaregroup.com. David Curtis, paint for us a picture of residential in 2030.
So 7 years from now, I suspect that more people will be on home health, more people will be on hospice. The challenge for us is the nursing workforce is not growing or perhaps contracting. At the same time, beneficiaries on Medicare and people who would benefit from these services are growing much faster. And so how do we care for this growing population with limited resources, with a limited supply of nurses? I think the demand's going to be there. We have to figure out how to smartly allocate the workforce to care for patients. And so I think there's going to be more demand. Exactly how those services get delivered, I think that's what we need to figure out in the next 7 years.
A lot of baby boomers. They've been living well. Overweight, not exercising,
mm-hmm.
Technology saves them. What do you say to our baby boomers tonight?
Yeah, I just turned 54 August 1st, and with a 4-year-old at the time, and I don't want to miss the fun. I don't want to miss the parties, and I think staying active. I don't think there's any secret sauce here, but I think staying active. I'm against retirement. We got to keep working. Taking care of yourself. I'm actually reading a book right now called Younger Next Year. And they say exercise 6 days a week minimum. So I think being sedentary and slowing down causes all these other problems to manifest themselves. And you are right about obesity in our country. It's out of hand and only getting worse. And that's what the profile, not all our patients, but a lot of our patients, right, who are on home health with these chronic conditions and these comorbidities. Yes, genetics play a part of it, but the lifestyle is absolutely a part of it too. And so in your 50s, you got to preempt it.
All right. I believe since July of 2016, you've also been the president and CEO of Mary Free Bed at Home.
In Grand Rapids. So we partnered with them. We were already in Grand Rapids caring for patients. Mary Free Bed's a 100-year-old nursing home and a stellar rehab facility on the west side of the state. And they wanted to get into home health, and they reached out to us and said, we would like to partner with you. And so we've partnered with the team at Mary Free Bed on the west side of the state. That business is nearly quadrupled in the last 7 years, and it's been great. We partner with Mary Free Bed in West Michigan. We partnered with North Shore University Health System in Chicago, and also with Allegheny Health Network in Pittsburgh, where we work with them to take more patients who would traditionally stay in a hospital and get them home quicker.
A few years ago, you and Dana loaded up the family, and you moved to Nashville.
We did.
Everybody, it's all great news about Nashville. What is it about Nashville?
Well, we moved to Nashville for family reasons. My four children have 11 first cousins in Nashville, and I wanted my kids to grow up with their cousins. My wife's two sisters live in Nashville, and her parents are there. And so we moved there first and foremost for family. It also didn't hurt that the number one industry in Nashville is not country music, but healthcare. It's also nice to not pay state income tax, given the choice. And so Nashville, at the same time, it was very hard for me to leave Michigan. My roots were here. I still have lifelong friends here. I miss my friends in Michigan. But Nashville has been great for family first. I would say for work second. But I still love coming home, and I still root for all the sports teams. The Lions have been rebuilding since 1957. I went to their only playoff game that they won in January '92 when we blew out the Cowboys. And so my fandom, if you will, and my allegiance to Detroit is still remains strong. But Nashville, you got to come visit, Jack. It's an exciting place.
I will. We will. David Curtis, I admire you. It's an honor to call you friend. Same. Thanks for all you do, not just business-wise, but giving back. You and Dana, fabulous people.
Jack, it's a pleasure to be here with you. Longtime fan of you and your show and the stories you tell and how you lift up the idea that with God, anything is possible. My life is a testament to that. And I'm excited for the next chapter.
Please join us next Saturday. Thank you. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoken. Believe in yourself.